narrowed eyes rested briefly on the unfamiliar Land Rover. Stryker had scrambled into the front seat as best he could, keeping his head low. Robin put her foot down and drove away at once. "She didn't give me a second look when I was following her," Stryker pointed out, hoisting himself into a sitting position. "You still shouldn't let her see you if you can help it," said Robin sententiously, "in case she noticed you and it reminds her."
"Sorry, forgot you're highly commended," said Stryker.
"Oh, sod off," said Robin with a flash of temper. Stryker was surprised.
"I was joking."
Robin turned into a parking space further up the street, out of sight of the Crow's Nest entrance, then checked her handbag for a small package she had brought earlier in the afternoon. "You wait here."
"The hell I will. I'll be in the car park keeping an eye out for Brockbank. Give me the keys."
She handed them over with ill grace and left. Stryker watched her walking towards the pub, wondering about that sudden spurt of temper. Perhaps, he thought, Matthew belittled what he probably saw as meager achievements. The Crow's Nest stood where Ferry and Stanley Roads met and formed a hairpin bend, a large, drum-shaped building of red brick. Holly was still standing in the doorway, smoking and drinking her pint. Nerves fluttered in the pit of Robin's stomach. She had volunteered for this. Now hers was the sole responsibility for finding out where Brockbank was. Her stupidity at bringing the police down on them earlier had made her touchy, and Stryker's ill-timed humour had reminded her of Matthew's subtly belittling comments about her counter-surveillance training. After formal congratulations on her top marks, Matthew had implied that what she had learned was, after all, no more than common sense. Robin's mobile rang in her coat pocket. Aware of Holly's eyes on her as she approached, Robin pulled out the phone to check the caller's name. It was her mother. On the basis that it would look slightly more unusual to switch off the call than to take it, she raised it to her ear.
"Robin?"
came Linda's voice, as Robin passed Holly in the doorway without looking at her.
"Are you in Barrow-in-Furness?"
"Yes," said Robin. Confronted by two inner doors, she chose the one on the left, which brought her into a large, high-ceilinged and dingy barroom. Two men in the now familiar blue overalls were playing pool at a table just inside the door. Robin sensed, rather than saw, the turning of several heads towards the stranger. Avoiding all eye contact, she drifted towards the bar as she continued her call.
"What are you doing there?"
asked Linda, and without waiting for a response, "we've had the police on the phone, checking whether Dad lent you the car."
"It was all a misunderstanding," said Robin. "Mum, I really can't talk now."
The door opened behind her and Holly walked past, thickly tattooed arms folded, giving Robin a sideways look of appraisal, and she sensed animosity. Apart from the short-haired barmaid, they were the only two females in the place.
"We called the flat," her mother went on, unheeding, "and Matthew said you'd gone away with Cormoran."
"Yes," said Robin.
"And when I asked whether you'd have time to drop round for lunch this weekend..."
"Why would I be in Massam this weekend?" Robin asked, confused. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw Holly taking a bar stool and chatting to several more blue-overalled men from the BAE factory.
"It's Matthew's dad's birthday," said her mother.
"Oh, of course it is," said Robin. She had completely forgotten. There was to be a party. It had been on the calendar so long that she had got used to the sight of it and forgotten that the trip back to Massam was actually going to happen.
"Robin, is everything all right?"
"Like I said, Mum, I can't really talk right now," said Robin.
"Are you all right?"
"Yes," said Robin impatiently.
"I'm absolutely fine. I'll ring you later."
She hung up and turned to the bar. The barmaid, who was waiting to take her order, wore the same look of shrewd appraisal as the watching neighbour in Stanley Road. There was an extra layer to their caginess around here. But Robin understood, now, that theirs was not the chauvinistic antagonism of the local for the stranger. Rather, it was the protectiveness of a people whose business was confidential.
With her heart beating slightly faster than usual, Robin said with an air of forced confidence,
"Hi. I don't know whether you can help me. I'm looking for Holly Brockbank. I was told she might be in here."
The barmaid considered Robin's request and then said, unsmiling,
"That's her. Down the bar. Can I get her something?"
"A glass of white wine, please," said Robin.
The woman whom she was impersonating would drink wine, Robin knew. She would also be unfazed by the edge of mistrust she saw in the barmaid's eyes, by Holly's reflexive antagonism, by the up-and-down stares of the pool players. The woman whom she was pretending to be was cool, clear-headed, and ambitious. Robin paid for her drink, then headed directly for Holly and the three men chatting to her at the bar. Curious but cagey, they fell silent when it became clear that they were Robin's destination.
"Hello," said Robin, smiling. "Are you Holly Brockbank?"
"Yeah," said Holly, her expression grim. "Were you?"
"Sorry?"
Aware of several pairs of amused eyes on her, Robin kept her smile in place by sheer force of will.
"Who are you?"
asked Holly, in a mock London accent.
"My name's Venetia Hall."
"Oh, unlucky,"
said Holly, with a broad grin at the closest workman who sniggered. Robin pulled a business card out of her handbag, freshly printed that afternoon on a machine in a shopping centre, while Strike remained behind, keeping an eye on Holly in the bakery. It had been Strike's suggestion that she use her middle name.
"Makes you sound like a poncy southerner."
Robin handed over the business card, looked boldly into Holly's heavily cold eyes, and repeated,
"Venetia Hall. I'm a lawyer."
Holly's grin evaporated. Scowling, she read the card, one of 200 Robin had had printed for £4.50. "Hardacre and Hall, personal injury lawyers. Venetia Hall, senior partner. Telephone 0888-789-654. Fax 0888-465-877. Email venetia@hnhlegal.co.uk.
"I'm looking for your brother Noel," said Robin.
How did thou know I was here?"
In her mistrust, she seemed to be swelling, bristling like a cat.
"A neighbour said you might be."
Holly's blue overalled companion smirked.
"We might have some good news for your brother," Robin ploughed on bravely. "We're trying to find him."
"I don't know where he is, and I don't care."
Two of the workmen slid away from the bar towards a table, leaving only one behind, who smiled faintly as he observed Robin's discomfiture. Holly drained her pint, slid a fiver sideways at the remaining man, and told him to get her another, clambered off her bar stool, and strode away towards the ladies, her arms held stiffly like a man's.
"A boy when her don't speak,"
said the barmaid, who had drifted up the bar to eavesdrop. She seemed to feel vaguely sorry for Robin.
"I don't suppose you know where Noel is?" Robin asked, feeling desperate.
"He's not been in here for a year or more," said the barmaid vaguely. "You know where he is, Kev?"
Holly's friend answered only with a shrug and ordered Holly's pint. His accent revealed him to be Glaswegian.
"Well, it's a pity," said Robin, and her clear, cool voice did not betray the frantic pounding of her heart.
She dreaded going back to Strike with nothing.
"There could be a big payout for the family, if only I can find him."
She turned to go.
"For the family or for him?"
asked the Glaswegian sharply.
"It depends,"
said Robin coolly, turning back. She did not imagine that Venetia Hall would be particularly chummy with people unconnected to the case she was building.
"If family members have had to take on a carer role, but I'd need details to judge.
Some relatives," lied Robin, "have had very significant compensation."
Holly was coming back. Her expression turned thunderous when she saw Robin talking to Kevin.
Robin walked off to the ladies herself, her heart pounding in her chest, wondering whether the lie she had just told would bear fruit. By the look on Holly's face as they passed each other, Robin thought there was an outside chance that she might be cornered by the Sinks and beaten up. However, when she came out of the bathroom, she saw Holly and Kevin nose to nose at the bar. Robin knew not to push any harder. Either Holly bit, or she did not. She tied her coat belt more tightly and walked, unhurriedly but purposefully, back past them towards the door.
"Oi?"
"Yes," said Robin, still a little coolly, because Holly had been rude, and Benicia Hall was used to a certain level of respect.
"All right. What's it all about?"
Though Kevin seemed keen to participate in their conversation, his relationship with Holly was apparently not far enough advanced to permit listening in on private financial matters. He drifted away to a fruit machine, looking disgruntled.
"We can yatter over here,"
Holly told Robin, taking her fresh pint and pointing Robin to a corner table beside a piano. The pub's windowsill bore ships in bottles, pretty, fragile things compared to the huge, sleek monsters that were being constructed beyond the windows, behind that high perimeter wall. The heavily patterned carpet would conceal a thousand stains. The plants behind the curtains looked droopy and sad, yet the mismatched ornaments and sporting trophies gave a homey feel to the large room, the bright blue overalls of its customers an impression of brotherhood. Hardacre and Hall is representing a large group of servicemen who suffered serious and preventable injury outside the field of combat, said Robin, sliding into her pre-rehearsed spiel. While we were reviewing records, we came across your brother's case. We can't be sure until we talk to him, of course, but he'd be very welcome to add his name to our pool of litigants. His would be very much the type of case we're expecting to win. If he joins us, it'll add to the pressure on the army to pay. The more complainants we can get, the better. It would be at no cost to Mr. Brockbank, of course. No win, she said, mimicking the TV adverts. No fee. Holly said nothing. Her pale face was hard and set. There were cheap rings of yellow gold on every digit except her wedding ring finger.
Kevin said something about the family getting money.
Oh, yes, said Robin blithely. If Noel's injuries have impacted you as a family.
Oh, I right they have,
snarled Holly.
How?
Asked Robin, taking a notebook out of her shoulder bag and waiting, pencil poised. She could tell that alcohol and a sense of grievance were going to be her greatest allies in extracting maximum information from Holly, who was now warming to the idea of telling the story she thought the lawyer wanted to hear. The first thing to be done was to soften that first impression of animosity towards her injured brother. Carefully, she took Robin over Noel joining the army at 16. He had given it everything. It had been his life. Oh yeah, people didn't realize the sacrifices soldiers made. Did Robin know Noel was her twin? Yeah, born on Christmas Day. Noel and Holly. To tell this bolderized story of her brother was to elevate herself. The man with whom she had shared a womb had sallied forth into the world, travelled and fought, and been promoted through the ranks of the British Army. His bravery and sense of adventure reflected back on her, left behind in Barrow.
And he married a woman called Irene, widow. Took her on with two kids, Jesus. No good turn goes unpunished, don't they say?
What do you mean? Asked Benicia Hall politely, clasping half an inch of warm vinegary wine.
Married her, had a son with her. Lovely little boy, Ryan, lovely. We've not seen him for 6 years, is it? 7 years, bitch.
Yeah, Irene just fucked off when he was at the doctor's one day. Took the kids. And his son was everything to Noel, mind. Everything. So much for in sickness and fucking health, eh? Some fucking wife. When he needed support most, bitch.
So Noel and Brittany had long since parted company.
Or had he made it his business to track down the stepdaughter, whom he surely blamed as much as Strike, for his life-changing injuries? Robin maintained an impassive expression, although her heart was racing. She wished she could text Strike right there and then. After his wife had left, Noel had turned up uninvited at the old family home, the tiny two-up, two-down on Stanley Road, in which Holly had lived all her life, and which she had occupied alone since her stepfather had died.
"I took him in," said Holly, straightening her back. "Family's family."
There was no mention of Brittany's allegation. Holly was playing the concerned relative, the devoted sister, and if it was a ham performance, Robin was experienced enough now to know that there were usually nuggets of truth to be sifted from even the most obvious dross. She wondered whether Holly knew about the accusation of child abuse. It had happened in Germany, after all, and no charges had been brought. Yet if Brockbank had been truly brain-damaged on his discharge, would he have been canny enough to remain silent about the reason for his ignominious exit from the army? If he had been innocent and not of sound mind, wouldn't he have talked, perhaps endlessly, of the injustice that had brought him to such a low ebb? Robin bought Holly a third pint and turned her deftly to the subject of what Noel had been like after he had been invalided out.
"He wasn't himself. Fits. Seizures. He was on a load of medication. I just go over nursing me stepfather. He had a stroke, and then I gets no coming home with his convulsions and..."
Holly buried the end of her sentence in her pint. "That's tough," said Robin, who was now writing in a small notebook. "Any behavioural difficulties? Families often mention those kinds of challenges as the worst."
"Yeah," said Holly. "Well, his temper wasn't improved by getting his brain knocked out of his skull for him. He smashed up the house for us twice. He was always raging at us."
"He's famous now, the Norse," said Holly darkly.
"Sorry," said Robin, thrown.
"The gadgie that beat him up." "The gadge. Cameron fucking Strike."
"Ah, yes," said Robin. "I think I've heard of him."
"Oh, yeah. Fucking private detective now in all the papers. Fucking military policeman when he beat the shit out of Noel. Fucking damaged him for fucking life."
The rant went on for some time. Robin made notes, waiting for Holly to tell her why the military police had come for her brother, but she either did not know or was determined not to say. All that was certain was that Noel Brockbank had attributed his epilepsy entirely to the actions of Strike. After what sounded like a year of purgatory, during which Noel had treated both his twin sister and her house as convenient outlets for his misery and his temper, he left for a bouncer's job in Manchester, obtained for him by an old Barovian friend. "He was well enough to work then?" asked Robin, because the picture Holly had painted was of a man totally out of control, barely able to contain explosions of temper.
"Yeah, well, he was all right by then, as long as he didn't drink and took his meds. I were glad to see the back of him. Took it out of me, having him here," said Holly,
suddenly remembering that there was a payout promised to those whose lives had been badly affected by their relatives' injuries.
"I had panic attacks, went to my GP. It's in my records."
The full impact of Brockbank's bad behaviour on Holly's life filled the next 10 minutes. Robin nodding seriously and sympathetically and interjecting encouraging phrases such as, "Yes, I've heard that from other relatives," and, "Oh yes, that would be very valuable in a submission." Robin offered the now tractable Holly a fourth pint.
"I'll get you one," said Holly,
with a vague show of getting to her feet. "No, no, this is all on expenses," said Robin. As she waited for the fresh pint of McEwan's to be poured, she checked her mobile. There was another text from Matthew, which she did not open, and one from Strike, which she did. "All okay?" "Yes," she texted back. "So your brother's in Manchester?" she asked Holly on her return to the table.
"No," said Holly, after taking a large swig of McEwan's. "He was sacked."
"Oh, really?" said Robin, pencil poised. "If it was a result of his medical condition, you know, we can help with an unfair dismissal."
"It weren't 'cause of that," said Holly.
A strange expression crossed the tight, sullen face, a flash of silver between storm clouds, of something powerful trying to break through.
"He come back here," said Holly, "and it all started again."
More stories of violence, irrational rages, broken furniture, at the end of which Brockbank had secured another job, vaguely described as security, and taken off for Market Harborough.
"And then he came back again," said Holly,
and Robin's pulse quickened. "So he's here in Barrow?" she asked.
"No," said Holly.
She was drunk now, and finding it harder to retain the hold on the line she was supposed to be peddling.
"He just come back for a couple of weeks, but this time I told him I'd have the police on him if he come back again, and he left for good."
"Need a slash," said Holly. "And a fag. Just smoke."
Robin shook her head. Holly got a little unsteadily to her feet and proceeded to the ladies, leaving Robin to pull her mobile out of her pocket and text Strike. "Says he's not in Barrow, not with family. She's drunk, still working on her. She's about to go outside for a cig. Lie low." She regretted the last two words as soon as she had pressed send, in case they elicited another sarcastic reference to her counter-surveillance course. But her phone buzzed almost immediately, and she saw two words: "Will do." When Holly finally returned to the table, smelling strongly of Rothmans, she was carrying a white wine, which she slid across to Robin, and her fifth pint.
"Thanks very much," said Robin.
"See," said Holly plaintively, as though there had been no break in the conversation, "it was having a real impact on me health, having him here."
"I'm sure," said Robin.
"So does Mr. Brockbank live?" "He was violent. I told you about the time he shoved me head into the fridge door."
"You did, yes," said Robin patiently.
"And he blacked me eye when I tried to stop him smashing up me mum's plates."
"Awful."
"You'd certainly be in line for some kind of payout," lied Robin. And ignoring a tiny qualm of guilt, she plunged straight towards the central question. "We assumed Mr. Brockbank was here in Barrow, because this is where his pension's being paid." Holly's reactions were slower after 4.5 pints. The promise of compensation for her suffering had given her a glow. Even the deep line that life had graven between her eyebrows, and which gave her a look of permanent fury, seemed to have diminished. However, the mention of Brockbank's pension turned her muzzily defensive.
"No, it's not," said Holly.
"According to our records, it is," said Robin.
The fruit machine played a synthetic jingle and flashed in the corner. The pool balls clicked and thudded off the bays. Barovian accents mingled with Scots. Robin's flash of intuition came to her like certain knowledge. Holly was helping herself to the military pension.
"Of course," said Robin, with a convincing lightness. "We know Mr. Brockbank might not be picking it up for himself. Relatives are sometimes authorized to collect money when the pensioner is incapacitated."
"Yeah,"
said Holly at once. A blush was creeping blotchily up her pale face. It made her look girlish, notwithstanding the tattoos and multiple piercings.
"I collected it for him when he was first out, when he was having fits."
Why, thought Robin, if he was so incapacitated, did he transfer the pension to Manchester, and then to Market Harborough, and then back to Barrow again?
"So are you sending it on to him now?" asked Robin, her heart beating fast again. "Or can he pick it up for himself now?"
"Listen," said Holly.
There was a Hell's Angels tattoo on her upper arm,
a wing-helmeted skull that rippled as she leaned in towards Robin. Beer, cigarettes and sugar had turned her breath rancid. Robin did not flinch.
"Listen," she said again. "You get people payouts like if they've been hurt, like, or wherever."
"That's right," said Robin.
"What if someone had been... What if social services should have done someone and they never?"
"It would depend on the circumstances," said Robin.
"Our mom left when we was 9, said Holly. "Left us with our stepfather."
"I'm sorry," said Robin. "That's tough."
1970s, said Holly. "Nobody gave a shit. Child abuse."
A lead weight dropped inside Robin. Holly's bad breath was in her face, her mottled face close. She had no idea that the sympathetic lawyer who had approached her with a promise of sacks of free cash was only a mirage.
"He'd done it to both of us," said Holly. "Misstep. Noel got it and all. From when we was tiny, we used to hide under our beds together, and then Noel did it to me. Mind," she said, suddenly earnest, "he could be all right, Noel. We was close in there when we was little. Anyway," her tone revealed a sense of double betrayal, "when he was 16, he left us to join the army."
Robin, who had not meant to drink any more, picked up her wine and took a large slug. Holly's second abuser had also been her ally against her first, the lesser of two evils.
"Bastard he were," she said,
and Robin could tell she meant the stepfather, not the twin who had abused her, then disappeared abroad.
"He had an accident at work when I was 16, though, and after that I could manage him better. Industrial chemicals, fucker. Couldn't get it up after that. On so many painkillers and shit. And then, he had his stroke."
The look of determined malice on Holly's face told Robin exactly what kind of care the stepfather might have received at her hands.
"Fucker," she said quietly.
"Have you received counselling at all?" Robin heard herself ask. "I do sound like a poncy southerner." Holly snorted.
"Fuck no. You're the first person I've ever told. Suppose you've heard a lot of stories like this."
"Oh yes," said Robin. She owed Holly that.
"I told Noel last time he come back," said Holly,
5 pints to the bad now, and slurring her words badly.
"Fuck off and stay away from us. You leave, or I'm going to the police about what you did to us before and see what they think of that. After all, these little girls keep saying you fiddled with them."
The phrase turned the warm wine rancid in Robin's mouth.
"That's how he lost the job in Manchester. Groped a 13-year-old. Probably the same in Market Arbor. He wouldn't tell me why he was back, but I know he'll have done something like that again. He learned from the best," said Holly. "So could I sue?"
"I think," said Robin, fearful of giving advice that would cause further damage to the wounded woman beside her, "that the police would probably be your best bet." "Where is your brother?" she asked, desperate now to extract the information she wanted and leave.
"Dunno," said Holly. "When I told him I'd go to the police, he went berserk, but then..."
She mumbled something indistinct, something in which the word pension was just audible. "He told her she could keep the pension if she didn't go to the police." So there she sat, drinking herself into an early grave with the money her brother had given her not to reveal his abuse. Holly knew he was almost certainly still fiddling with other young girls. Had she ever known about Brittany's accusation? Did she care? Or had the scar tissue grown so thick over her own wounds that it rendered her impervious to other little girls' agony? She was still living in a house where it had all happened, with the front windows facing out on barbed wire and bricks. Why hadn't she run? Robin wondered. Why hadn't she escaped like Noel? Why stay in the house facing the high blank wall?
You haven't got a number for him or anything like that? Robin asked.
No, said Holly.
There could be big money in this if you can find me any kind of contact, said Robin desperately, throwing finesse to the wind.
Soul place,
Holly slurred after a few minutes' muddled thought and fruitless staring at her phone.
And Market Arbre.
It took a long time to locate the telephone number of Noel's last place of work, but at last they found it. Robin made a note, then dug £10 out of her own purse and thrust it into Holly's willing hand.
You've been very helpful indeed.
It's just gadgets, isn't it? All the same.
Yes, said Robin, without a clue what she was agreeing to.
I'll be in touch. I've got your address.
She stood up.
Yeah. See, though. Just gadgets. All the same.
She means men, said the barmaid, who had come over to collect some of Holly's many empty glasses, and was smiling at Robin's clear bewilderment.
A gadget is a man. She's saying men are all the same.
Oh, yes, said Robin, barely aware of what she was saying. So true.
Thanks very much. Goodbye, Holly. Take care of yourself.
Chapter 26 Desolate Landscape, Storybook Bliss. Blue Oyster Cult, Death Valley Nights.
Psychology's loss, said Strike, is private detection's gain. That was bloody good going, Robin.
He raised his can of McEwan's and toasted her. They were sitting in the parked Land Rover, eating fish and chips, a short distance away from the Olympic takeaway. Its bright windows intensified the surrounding darkness. Silhouettes passed regularly across the rectangles of light, metamorphosed into three-dimensional humans as they entered the bustling chip shop and turned back into shadows as they left.
So his wife left him?
Yep.
And Holly says he hasn't seen the kid since.
Right.
Strike sipped his McEwan's, thinking. He wanted to believe that Brockbank really had lost contact with Brittany, but what if the evil bastard had somehow tracked her down?
We still don't know where he is, though, Robin sighed.
Well, we know he isn't here, and that he hasn't been here for around a year, said Strike. We know he still blames me for what's wrong with him, that he's still abusing little girls, and that he's a fuck sight saner than they thought he was in the hospital.
Why do you say that?
Sounds like he's kept the accusation of child abuse quiet. He's holding down jobs when he could be sitting at home claiming disability benefit. I suppose working gives him more opportunities to meet young girls.
Don't, murmured Robin, as the memory of Holly's confession suddenly gave way to that of the frozen head, looking so young, so plump, so dimly surprised.
That's Brockbank and Lang, both at large in the UK, both hating my guts.
Chomping chips, Strike rummaged in the glove compartment, extracting the road atlas, and for a while was quiet, turning pages. Robin folded the remainder of her fish and chips in its newspaper wrappings and said,
I've got to ring my mother, back in a bit.
Leaning against a street lamp a short distance away, she called her parents' number.
Are you all right, Robin?
Yes, Mum.
What's going on between you and Matthew?
Robin looked up at the faintly starry sky.
I think we've split up.
You think?
Said Linda. She sounded neither shocked nor sad, merely interested in the full facts. Robin had been worried that she might cry when she had to say it aloud, yet no tears stung her eyes, nor did she need to force herself to speak calmly. Perhaps she was toughening up. The desperate life story of Holly Brockbank and the gruesome end of the unknown girl in Shepherd's Bush certainly gave a person perspective.
It only happened on Monday night.
Was this because of Cormoran?
No.
said Robin.
Sarah Shadlock. It turns out Matt was sleeping with her while I was at home. When? You know when. After I dropped out. Two young men meandered out of the Olympic, definitely the worse for drink, shouting and swearing at each other. One of them spotted Robin and nudged the other. They veered towards her.
"Thou art right, darling."
Strike got out of the car and slammed the door, looming darkly, a head taller than both of them. The youth swayed away in sudden silence. Strike lit a cigarette leaning up against the car, his face in shadow.
"Mum, are you still there?"
"He told you this on Monday night?" asked Linda.
"Yes," said Robin.
"Why?"
"We were rowing about Cormoran again," Robin muttered, aware of Strike yards away. "I said, it's a platonic relationship like you and Sarah. And then I saw his face. And then he admitted it."
Her mother gave a long, deep sigh. Robin waited for words of comfort or wisdom.
"Dear God," said Linda.
There was another long silence.
"How are you really, Robin?"
"I'm all right, Mum. Honestly, I'm working. It's helping."
"Why are you in Barrow, of all places?"
"We're trying to trace one of the men Strike thinks might have sent him the leg."
"Where are you staying?"
"We're going to go to the Travel Lodge," said Robin. "In separate rooms, obviously," she hastened to add.
"Have you spoken to Matthew since you left?"
"He keeps sending me texts, telling me he loves me." As she said it, she realized that she had not read his last. She had only just remembered it.
"I'm sorry," Robin told her mother. "The dress and the reception and everything. I'm so sorry, Mum."
"They're the last things I'm worried about," said Linda. And she asked yet again, "Are you all right, Robin?"
"Yes, I promise I am."
She hesitated, then said, almost defiantly, "Cormoran's been great."
"You're going to have to talk to Matthew, though," said Linda. "After all this time, you can't not talk to him."
Robin's composure broke. Her voice trembled with rage, and her hands shook as the words poured out of her.
"We were at the rugby with them just 2 weekends ago with Sarah and Tom. She's been hanging around ever since they were at uni. They were sleeping together while I... He's never cut her out of his life. She's always hugging him, flirting with him, shit-stirring between him and me. At the rugby, it was Strike. Oh, he's so attractive. Just the two of you in the office, is it? And all this time, I thought it just went one way. I knew she tried to get him into bed at uni, but I never... 18 months they were sleeping together. And you know what he said to me? She was comforting him. I had to give in and say she could come to the wedding because I'd asked Strike without telling Matt. That was my punishment because I didn't want her there. Matt has lunch with her whenever he's near her offices. I'm going to come down to London and see you," said Linda.
"No, Mum, for a day. Take you out for lunch." Robin gave a weak laugh.
"Mum, I don't take a lunch hour. It isn't that kind of job."
"I'm coming to London, Robin." When her mother's voice became firm like that, there was no point arguing.
"I don't know when I'll be back."
"Well, you can let me know and I'll book the train."
"I... Oh, okay," said Robin.
When they had bidden each other goodbye, she realized that she had tears in her eyes at last. Much as she might pretend otherwise, the thought of seeing Linda brought much comfort. She looked over at the Land Rover. Strike was still leaning up against it, and he too was on the phone. Or was he merely pretending? She had been talking loudly. He could be tactful when he chose. She looked down at the mobile in her hands and opened Matthew's message. "Your mother called. I told her you're away with work. Let me know whether you want me to tell Dad you're not going to his birthday thing. I love you, Robin. M. 6 kisses. There he went again. He did not really believe that the relationship was at an end. "Let me know whether you want me to tell Dad." As though it were a storm in a teacup. As though she would never take it so far as not to attend his father's party. "I don't even like your bloody father." Angry, she typed and sent the response. "Of course I'm not coming."
She got back into the car. Strike seemed to be genuinely talking on the phone. The road atlas lay open on the passenger seat. He had been looking at the Leicestershire town of Market Harborough.
"Yeah, you too," she heard Strike say. "Yeah. See you when I get back."
Ellen, she thought. He climbed back into the car. "Was that Wardle?" she asked innocently.
"Ellen," he said.
"Does she know you've gone away with me? Just the two of us?" Robin felt herself turn red. She did not know where that thought had come from. It wasn't as though... "You want to go to Market Harborough?" she asked, holding up the map.
"Might as well," said Strike, taking another swig of beer. "It's the last place Brockbank worked. Could get a lead. We'd be stupid not to check it out. And if we're going through there..."
He lifted the book out of her hands and flicked over a few pages.
"It's only 12 miles from Corby. We could swing by and see whether the Lang, who was shacked up with a woman there in 2008, is our Lang. She's still living there. Lorraine McNaughton's the name."
Robin was used to Strike's prodigious memory for names and details. "Okay," she said, pleased to think that the morning would bring more investigation, not simply a long drive back to London. Perhaps if they found something interesting, there would be a second night on the road, and she need not see Matthew for another 12 hours. But then she remembered that Matthew would be heading north the following night for his father's birthday. She would have the flat to herself in any case.
"Could he have tracked her down?"
Strike wondered aloud, after a silence.
"Sorry, what? Who?"
"Could Brockbank have tracked Brittany down and killed her after all this time? Or am I barking up the wrong tree because I feel so fucking guilty?"
He gave the door of the Land Rover a soft thump with his fist.
"The leg, though," said Strike, arguing against himself. "It's scarred just like hers was. That was a thing between them. I tried to saw off your leg when you were little and your mum walked in. Fucking evil bastard. Who else would send me a scarred leg?"
"Well," said Robin slowly, "I can think of a reason the leg was chosen, and it might not have anything at all to do with Brittany Brockbank." Strike turned to look at her.
"Go on."
"Whoever killed that girl could have sent you any part of her and achieved the same result," said Robin.
"An arm or a breast?"
She did her best to keep her tone matter-of-fact. "Would have meant the police and the press swarming all over us just the same. The business would still have been compromised, and we'd have been just as shaken up. But he chose to send a right leg. Cut exactly where your right leg was amputated."
"I suppose it ties in with the effing song. Although..."
Strike reconsidered.
"No, I'm talking crap, aren't I? An arm would have worked just as well for that. Or a neck."
"He's making clear reference to your injury," Robin said. "What does your missing leg mean to him?"
"Christ knows," said Strike,
watching her profile as she talked.
"Heroism," said Robin.
Strike snorted.
"There's nothing heroic about being in the wrong place at the wrong time."
"You're a decorated veteran."
"I wasn't decorated for being blown up. That happened before."
"You've never told me that."
She turned to face him, but he refused to be sidetracked.
"Go on. Why the leg?"
"Your injury's a legacy of war. It represents bravery, adversity overcome. Your amputation's mentioned every single time they talk about you in the press. I think, for him, it's tied up with fame and achievement and honour. He's trying to denigrate your injury, to tie it to something horrible, divert the public's perception away from you as hero towards you as a man in receipt of part of a dismembered girl. He wants to cause you trouble, yes, but he wants to diminish you in the process. He's somebody who wants what you've got, who wants recognition and importance."
Strike bent down and took a second can of McEwan's out of the brown bag at his feet. The crack of the ring pull reverberated in the cold air.
"If you're right," said Strike,
watching his cigarette smoke curl away into the darkness. If what's roiling this maniac is that I got famous, Whittaker goes to the top of the list. That was all he ever wanted, to be a celebrity.
Robin waited. He had told her virtually nothing about his stepfather, although the internet had supplied her with many of the details that Stryke had withheld.
"He was the most parasitic fucker I've ever met," said Stryke. "It'd be like him to try and siphon off a bit of fame from someone else."
She could feel him becoming angry again beside her in the small space. He reacted consistently at every mention of each of the three suspects. Brockbank made him guilty, Whittaker angry. Lang was the only one he discussed with anything like objectivity. "Hasn't Shanker come up with anything yet?"
"Says he's in Catford. Shanker'll track him down. Whittaker'll be there somewhere, in some filthy corner. He's definitely in London."
"Why are you so sure?"
"Just London, isn't it?" said Stryke, staring across the car park at the terraced houses. "He came from Yorkshire originally, Whittaker, you know. But he's pure Cockney now."
"You haven't seen him for ages, have you?"
"I don't need to. I know him. He's part of the junk that washes up in the capital looking for the big time and never leaves. He thought London was the only place that deserved him. Had to be the biggest stage for Whittaker."
Yet Whittaker had never managed to claw his way out of the dirty places of the capital where criminality, poverty and violence bred like bacteria. The underbelly where Shanker still dwelled. Nobody who had not lived there would ever understand that London was a country unto itself. They might resent it for the fact that it held more power and money than any other British city, but they could not understand that poverty carried its own flavour there, where everything cost more, where the relentless distinctions between those who had succeeded and those who had not were constantly, painfully visible. The distance between Ellen's vanilla-columned flat in Clarence Terrace and the filthy Whitechapel squat where his mother had died could not be measured in mere miles. They were separated by infinite disparities, by the lotteries of birth and chance, by faults of judgment and lucky breaks. His mother and Ellen, both beautiful women, both intelligent, one sucked down into a morass of drugs and human filth, the other sitting high over Regent's Park, behind spotless glass. Robin, too, was thinking about London. It had Matthew in its spell. But he had no interest in the labyrinthine worlds she probed daily during her detective work. He looked excitedly towards the surface glitter, the best restaurants, the best areas to live, as though London were a huge monopoly board. He had always had a divided allegiance to Yorkshire, to their hometown, Massam. His father was Yorkshire-born, while his late mother had come from Surrey and had carried with her an air of having gone north on sufferance. She had persistently corrected any Yorkshire turns of speech in Matthew and his sister Kimberly. His carefully neutral accent had been one of the reasons that Robin's brothers had not been impressed when they had started dating. In spite of her protestations, in spite of his Yorkshire name, they had sensed the wannabe southerner.
"It'd be a strange place to come from, this, wouldn't it?" said Stryke, still looking out over the terraces. "It's like an island. I've never heard that accent before, either."
A man's voice sounded somewhere nearby, singing a rousing song. Robin thought at first that the tune was a hymn. Then the man's unique voice was joined by more voices, and the breeze changed direction, so that they heard a few lines quite distinctly. "Friends to share in games and laughter, songs at dusk and books at noon." "School song," said Robin, smiling. She could see them now, a group of middle-aged men in black suits, singing loudly as they walked up Buccleuch Street.
"Funeral," guessed Stryke. "Old schoolmate. Look at them."
As the black-suited men drew level to the car, one of them spotted Robin looking.
"Barrow Boys Grammar School,"
he shouted at her, fist raised, as though he had just scored a goal. The men cheered, but there was melancholy to their drink-fueled swagger. They began singing the song again as they passed out of sight.
harbour lights and clustered shipping, clouds above the wheeling gulls.
Hometowns, said Strike.
He was thinking about men like his Uncle Ted, a Cornishman to his bones, who had lived and would die in St. Moore's, part of the fabric of the place, remembered as long as there were locals, beaming out of fading photographs of the lifeboat on pub walls. When Ted died, and Strike hoped it would be 20, 30 years hence, they would mourn him as the unknown Barovian grammar boy was being mourned, with drink, with tears, but in celebration that he had been given to them. What had dark, hulking Brockbank, child rapist, and fox-haired Lang, wife torturer, left behind in the towns of their birth? Shudders of relief that they had gone, fear that they had returned, a trail of broken people and bad memories. "Shall we go?" Robin asked quietly, and Strike nodded, dropping the burning stub of his cigarette into his last inch of McEwan's, where it emitted a small, satisfying hiss. Chapter 27. A dreadful knowledge comes. Blue Oyster Cult, in the presence of another world. They were given rooms 5 doors apart in the travel lodge. Robin had dreaded the man behind the desk offering a double room, but Strike had headed that off with a peremptory 2 singles, before he had time to open his mouth. Ridiculous, really, to feel suddenly self-conscious, because they had been physically closer all day in the Land Rover than they were in the lift. It felt odd saying goodnight to Strike when she reached the door of her room. Not that he lingered. He merely said, "Night," and walked on to his own room. But he waited outside his door until she managed to work the key card and let herself inside with a flustered wave. Why had she waved? Ridiculous. She dropped her holdall on the bed and moved to the window, which offered only a bleak view of the same industrial warehouses they had passed on their way into town a few hours earlier. It felt as though they had been away from London for much longer than they had. The heating was turned up too high. Robin forced open a stiff window, and the cool night air surged inside, eager to invade the stuffy square box of a room. After putting her phone onto charge, she undressed, pulled on a nightshirt, brushed her teeth, and slid down between the cool sheets. She still felt strangely unsettled, knowing that she was sleeping 5 rooms away from Strike. That was Matthew's fault, of course. If you sleep with him, we're over for good. Her unruly imagination suddenly presented her with the sound of a knock on the door. Strike inviting himself in on some slim pretext. Don't be ridiculous. She rolled over, pressing her flushed face into the pillow. What was she thinking? Damn Matthew, putting things in her head, judging her by himself. Strike, meanwhile, had not yet made it into bed. He was stiff all over from the long hours of immobility in the car. It felt good to get the prosthesis off. Even though the shower was not particularly handy for a man with one leg, he used it, carefully holding onto the bar inside the door, trying to relax his sore knee with hot water. Towel dried, he navigated his way carefully back to the bed, put his mobile onto charge, and climbed, naked, beneath the covers. Lying with his hands behind his head, he stared up at the dark ceiling and thought about Robin lying 5 rooms away. He wondered whether Matthew had texted again, whether they were on the phone together, whether she was capitalizing on her privacy to cry for the first time all day. The sounds of what was probably a stag party reached him through the floor, loud male laughter, shouting, whoops, slamming doors. Somebody put on music, and the bass pounded through his room. It reminded him of the nights he had slept in his office, when the music playing in the 12-bar cafe below had vibrated through the metal legs of his camp bed. He hoped the noise was not as loud in Robin's room. She needed her rest. She had to drive another 250 miles tomorrow. Yawning, Strike rolled over, and in spite of the thudding music and yells, fell almost immediately asleep. They met by agreement in the dining room next morning, where Strike blocked Robin from view as she surreptitiously refilled their flask from the urn at the buffet and both loaded their plates with toast. Strike resisted the full English and rewarded himself for his restraint by sliding several Danish pastries into his backpack. At 8 o'clock, they were back in the Land Rover, driving through the glorious Cumbrian countryside, a rolling panorama of heather moors and peatlands under a hazy blue sky, and joining the M6 south.
"Sorry I can't share the driving," said Strike, who was sipping coffee. "That clutch would kill me. It'd kill both of us."
"I don't care," said Robin. "I love driving, you know that." They sped on in companionable silence. Robin was the only person whom Strike could stand to be driven by, notwithstanding the fact that he had an ingrained prejudice against women drivers. This was something that he generally kept quiet, but which had its roots in many a negative passenger experience, from his Cornish aunt's nervous ineptitude, to his sister Lucy's distractibility, to Charlotte's reckless courting of danger. An ex-girlfriend from the SIB, Tracy, had been competent behind the wheel, and yet had become so paralyzed with fear on a high, narrow Alpine road that she had stopped, on the verge of hyperventilating, refusing to cede the wheel to him, but unable to drive further.
"Matthew liked the Land Rover?" Strike asked,
as they trundled over a flyover.
"No," said Robin. "He wants an A3 Cabriolet."
"Course he does," said Strike under his breath,
inaudible in the rattling car.
"Wanker."
It took them 4 hours to reach Market Harborough, a town which, as they established en route, neither Strike nor Robin had ever visited. The approach wound through a number of pretty little villages, with thatched roofs, 17th-century churches, topiary gardens, and residential streets with names like Honeypot Lane. Strike remembered the stark, blank wall, barbed wire, and looming submarine factory that had formed the view from Noel Brockbank's childhood home. What could have brought Brockbank here? The bucolic prettiness and charm. What kind of business owned the telephone number that Holly had given Robin, and which was now residing in Strike's wallet? The impression of genteel antiquity only increased when they reached Market Harborough itself. The ornate and aged church of St. Dionysius rose proudly in the heart of the town, and beside it, in the middle of the central thoroughfare, stood a remarkable structure resembling a small timbered house on wooden stilts. They found a parking space to the rear of this peculiar building. Keen to smoke and to stretch his knee, Strike got out, lit up, and went to examine a plaque that informed him the stilted edifice was a grammar school that had been built in 1614. Biblical verses painted in gold ran around the structure. "Man looketh on the outward appearance, but the Lord looketh on the heart." Robin had remained in the Land Rover, examining the map for the best route to Corby, their next stop. When Strike had finished his cigarette, he hoisted himself back into the passenger seat.
"Okay, I'm going to try the number. If you fancy stretching your legs, I'm nearly out of fags."
Robin rolled her eyes, but took the proffered tenner and left in search of Benson and Hedges. The number was engaged the first time Strike tried it. On his second attempt, a heavily accented female voice answered,
"Taioke Massage, how can I help you?"
"Hi," said Strike. "I've been given your number by a friend. Whereabouts are you?"
She gave him a number in St. Mary's Road, which he saw, after a brief consultation of the map, was mere minutes away.
"Any of your ladies free for me this morning?" he asked.
"What kind you like?"
said the voice. He could see Robin coming back in the wing mirror, her strawberry blonde hair blowing freely in the breeze, a gold pack of Benson and Hedges glinting in her hand.
"Dark," said Strike, after a fractional hesitation. "Toy."
"We had 2 Thai ladies free for you. What service you look for?"
Robin pulled open the driver's door and got back in.
"What have you got?" asked Strike.
"One lady central massage with oils, £90. 2 ladies central massage with oil, £120. Full body to body naked massage with oil, 150. You negotiate extras with the lady, okay?
Okay. I'd like the, one lady.